Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your guest host, Maggie Frazier, Communications Specialist here at U of M Extension. Today on the podcast, we're talking about soil fertility, fact or fiction. We have three members of Extension's Nutrient Management Team, Fabian Fernandez, Dan Kaiser, and Carl Rosen, to cover the basics and beyond. Welcome. How about you each give a brief introduction of yourselves?
This is Dan Kaiser. I'm a nutrient management specialist here in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. I'm also with University of Minnesota Extension.
Hi, this is Carl Rosen. I'm also with the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate and nutrient management specialist. I work a lot on irrigated systems, but also do quite a bit with specialty crops, some of the processing crops on dryland soils as well.
And I am Fabian Fernandez, also a nutrient management specialist here in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate. And my area of expertise is in nitrogen management for corn cropping systems and water quality.
All right, let's jump in. Fact or fiction? Plants prefer organic sources of nutrients because they are more available.
Well, that is actually fiction. In reality, organic molecules have to be changed to inorganic forms before the plants can use the nutrients. Plants don't take organic nutrients. They have to become inorganic molecules before they can be used by the crop. And so that's a misconception. And I think it maybe come from the fact that a lot of people talk about, you know, organic agriculture and things like that. But the reality is that plants will not take organic molecules as nutrients.
Right. And when you apply an organic fertilizer, it has to be broken down before it can be taken up, as Fabian said, in the most simplest forms, the ionic form. This isn't to say that there aren't benefits to organic fertilizer, organic nutrient sources. Manure, for example, helps improve soil quality in many different ways because of the carbon in there, and those things that help soil health, for example. But in terms of a nutrient source, they need to be broken down into the ionic form in order to be taken up by the plants.
Yeah, and this argument usually I see come across between organic groups and, you know, conventional ag groups. And, you know, what, you know, Fabian and Carl have said is both true. The main challenge I always see with organic sources, while they can be readily available, is always predicting that availability. So, you know, you see that a lot on, you know, it, you know, kind of just seeing people in, especially homeowners here in town in Menards, and them picking out things. A lot of them are really erring towards some of the organic sources. And really the main issue there is we just don't know the availability on some of these products. So we know that plants themselves, really between the two, don't really favor either. Don't really favor the organic. I mean, they're really looking for the inorganic sources. And really with the organic sources, it really just boils down to availability. So that's the main challenge with this one, and it comes up a lot, again, just in this argument versus why go organic. And really, in that from that standpoint, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just with the terms of nutrient sources, we know that really the inorganic is what that crop is looking for.
Right, and as follow-up on what Dan said, the availability is really temperature-dependent, particularly the carbon and nitrogen, the nitrogen, organic nitrogen sources. It's a microbial process to break it down, and so you need you know, ambient temperatures as well as moisture there for that product to go through that cycling to the inorganic form.
One with a lot of it too, again, it comes back to availability. And you look at a lot of these products, really the nutrient concentrations of them tend to be a lot lower. So that's one of the things when you look at total amounts required. You tend to see more of an organic source needed in most cases just because of all the extra stuff that's there, the extra carbon and everything else that's accounted for in those materials. So really, in terms of the two, it's just easier managing with inorganic just because higher concentrations, and it's a lot easier to predict availability and come up with a fertilizer application rate.
In addition to that, too, is in organic sources, they are not balanced, and so different sources have different concentrations of nutrients, and as Dan mentioned, they typically are lower concentration, but they're imbalanced. And so, for instance, typically with manure, if you're applying manure, you will be likely over-applying phosphorus and not applying enough nitrogen. And so it's a lot easier to deal with those balance with an inorganic source that is just one nutrient, or it has a specific concentration of each nutrient that you can balance more easily.
Fact or fiction? Micronutrients like sulfur are becoming more deficient with greater yielding crops.
You know, I love this one because this one comes up a lot, and lumping sulfur in with a micronutrient, and that's really the main fiction here, because sulfur, we know, is a macronutrient and it's needed in large quantities, and it comes up a lot when I'm on the road. People thinking of sulfur as a micronutrient, we can't really be looking at it, even though we've demonstrated you can do a lot in terms of increasing yield with a low rate of sulfur. It still isn't a micronutrient just because of the overall uptake.
Yeah, that's right. And technically, sulfur is considered a secondary macronutrient. The primary macronutrients are nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. Secondary macronutrients are sulfur, calcium, magnesium. And to kind of put it in perspective, if you look at uptake of a micronutrient, you're looking at maybe ounces of a micronutrient, something like zinc or copper, ounces per acre in terms of actual uptake by the crop, whereas macronutrients tend to be taken up in more in the pounds per acre, so maybe 30 pounds of sulfur might be needed for a high-yielding corn crop.
Yeah, and when we look at, you know, facts, we do know that uptake and removal are highly tied to yield. So there is some truth here in this question when we start talking about increasing crop yields with increasing removal. The question, and as Carl mentioned, is when we start talking about micronutrients, we typically measure the uptake in ounces to the acre. So say we increase crop yield by 30%, yes, we'll increase removal probably by about the same amount, although I think as Fabian, you know, before he came here to Minnesota, he was looking at this in Illinois, and we've also looked at it in here in terms of some of the nutrient concentrations actually declining slightly with some of these higher yielding crops. So it seems like they're breeding these crops to have a greater starch content, and you're really diluting down some of what's in there. So we haven't seen really that great of an increase, although we do know that there's a direct tie-in with removal, particularly when we start talking about our immobile nutrients, phosphorus, potassium, most of our micronutrients. So while they're becoming a greater demand, we haven't necessarily seen a great increase in the overall requirement, particularly for, we'll talk about a micronutrient like zinc in corn production, because we know that there's a greater uptake, but the uptake isn't as much. And still, when we look at a lot of our data, it really doesn't take a whole lot in a deficient situation to increase yield. So like I said, this is kind of one where there's some truth and there's some fact and fiction built in.
And just one more point of clarification. Carl, you mentioned the macronutrients being primary or secondary macronutrients, and the distinction there really, it has no very much to do with how much the plant takes. It has to do more with how much of those nutrients we normally apply in agriculture. Mm-hmm. So normally, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are the primary because those are the ones that we get the most response to and we normally apply on a regular basis. Sulfur, calcium, magnesium, historically we don't really need to apply those nutrients, although sulfur is becoming more of a nutrient that we apply on a more regular basis. And depending where you're from, you know, I grew up in Argentina. Argentina has a lot of sulfur deficiency, so that's kind of one of the major macronutrients in there, just because they have to apply more than potassium, for instance. So that's the only the distinction between, you know, these primary versus secondary, but they're all macronutrients because, as Carl mentioned, they are required by larger quantities by the plant.
And when you look at our macronutrients too, I mean, the only one really right now that we aren't tying any of our recommendations to the yield is nitrogen. And if you look at the data, we have a substantial amount of data when you look at the optimum nitrogen rate versus yield, that there hasn't really been a direct correlation. It's one thing I hear a lot right now, particularly when we start talking about some of these things that have been coming out with the nitrogen rule, has been being able to maintain, you know, increased nitrogen applications with increases in yield, and we just aren't necessarily seeing that those two go together. The removal basis, particularly for P and K, phosphorus and potassium, we know that with increased removal, we can see increases in the decline over time if we don't apply fertilizer in those given fields. Although it is very slow, on average, you're probably talking about a 2 part per million decrease for the Bray soil test over time without fertilizer application. If you're starting in, we'll say kind of a medium to high, you're not really an excessively high situation with manure, which we know that decline is a lot quicker, and probably about 4 parts per million or so with potassium. So those are kind of average. We would really expect those just based on removal. And nitrogen's kind of that outlier at this time.
All right, fact or fiction. Variable rate application of fertilizer will increase crop yield.
It's an interesting question. I think on average, I would say probably fiction, but it really depends on a lot of factors.
That's our favorite word in extension. It depends.
It depends, yeah.
Because it really does.
It could in some cases.
I mean, really, it's a question of how you're setting up the field with your soil sampling scheme. Because really, with variable rate, what you're really looking at doing is trying to even out the field. So you're trying to look at putting fertilizer where it's needed and then maybe cutting back where it's not needed. So we look at in terms of trimming back fertilizer, you apply less fertilizer, you wouldn't expect to get greater yields. So really what you're, again, looking at is identifying low areas that you may be under-fertilizing, particularly with phosphorus and potassium, and then looking at those areas that are grossly over-fertilized. Because, I mean, really looking at it in terms of variable rate, a lot of what you're looking at in terms of the benefit there is cost savings and looking at trying to reduce the cost in the area and trying to increase profitability, because we know the low areas are out there, but being able to fully identify them, that boils really down to the soil sampling scheme.
Yeah, and the other important thing too with all of these is that there are two kind of views to this, right? One is to kind of even out the fertility across the landscape so everything is uniform. The other one is to try to equalize the yields. Another one would be to improve the productivity or the returns, right? And those are two different things sometimes, because maybe an area where you get the highest yields and you apply a little bit more fertilizer, it can help increase that yield even more. Maybe that's where you want to put that fertilizer versus applying in an area that is not going to yield very much more. And so it's two different approaches, right, to how you apply fertilizers, whether you're trying to equalize the yield across the entire area so that the low yielding areas get higher yields, or if it's applying where you will get the most profitability.
Yeah, I guess if you're looking at your yield map and you apply the fertilizer where you have a high yield based on the yield map, but then on the other hand, you could be basing it on your soil test.
That's right.
So phosphorus, for example, you put the phosphorus where it's needed on that low area versus the high area, then you don't put it there. Same thing with potassium and pH. You know, you put the kind of even it out based on that soil test.
Yep.
But that not necessarily, you may not necessarily get higher yields in those areas.
Yeah, and I think it also comes down to, I mean, the approach that you're using and also understanding what's the level of confidence that you have in the data that you're using to base that application, right? If you're basing it off of a grid sampling that it's a very large grid sample, you know, the clarity that you get on that data is not very good. You know, if you're basing it out of, I don't know, a 10-acre grid sample or something like that, well, there is enough variability within that 10-acre field that you're probably not going to improve things very much. Now, if you go to a grid that is maybe 2 or 1 acre or something like that, then, okay, you may be able to start really getting closer to where you need to be looking at for management.
Well, and I think the main thing is, and you know, I think I said this before, is how you assess that variability, because we can do all, we've got the capability to really look at fine-tuning applications with what the variable rate spreaders that are out there. Really, the question is that starting point and soil sampling, and you know, how fine of a scale do you need to get to be able to really fine-tune applications.
And when we are talking about soil sampling, we are really talking about P and K. We are not really talking about nitrogen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nitrogen, I mean, you could look at it. I mean, we do have recommendations in areas of the state for using a 2-foot test. So if you wanted to look at variable rate application, I think there's some movement there that could be made. I think a lot of growers right now are looking at organic matter maps and probably assigning some sort of productivity values to try to look at fine-tuning their nitrogen recommendations. We just haven't been able to completely identify through research that, you know, these are practices that are effective for nitrogen. P and K, it's fairly easy, because if you look at the how we have the guidelines, I mean, really what we're looking at for most of our guidelines are probability functions. So looking at what probability, based on your given soil test, are you going to see some sort of yield response, whether profitable or not, from a fertilizer application. And then the question is, can we get all these low testing areas? Because if you look at a lot of the data, just you think of manure being a very variable application where you get a lot of variability imposed in your field with a manure application. I mean, the same thing can happen with the dry fertilizer applicators. I mean, if you're not looking at getting a real even spread out there, we see a lot of variability. And if you look at these fields, that's just imposed by our previous management. So it's really a question of how to best address that. And I think it'd drive you mad just trying to get to all the variability. You just need to come up with some sort of plan for a given field that works well to at least to get most of the variability. And really where I look at it is to try to get to those low areas, because those are really the areas that if you look at profitability is going to be high, where you can at least double your fertilizer investment in those areas. Then outside of those areas, then if you're getting an area that's pretty consistently in that high range, I mean, then you probably don't have to look at managing it down to a very small scale, because overall the probability of a yield response is going to be low. So it's not a one-size-fits-all strategy, but it's really looking at in terms of how do we view these things paying for themselves, and not necessarily viewing it as that we automatically that this technology is going to give us a yield increase, because that's really not likely what's going to happen. We're looking at trying to better handle that variability within the field
and be more efficient with the fertilizers as well.
Yeah, I don't know. Corn and soybeans is simple. I don't know. Yeah. Canning crops, if it's as with that, or potatoes. I mean, the different animals in terms of what happens with right. fertilizer and how they respond.
Well, to some degree, but I think P and K are probably, we still have the same probability functions, and pH, lime applications would be very similar as well.
Yeah. All right, fact or fiction. Anhydrous ammonia is bad for soil microbes, destroys organic matter, and makes soils hard.
that's one of those that keeps coming up all the time. And the most difficult thing sometimes is when they're kind of half truth. There is some truth to some of these things, but they don't necessarily completely apply. So let's start with the soil microbes. So anhydrous ammonia, it does kill the microbes where in the retention zone of that ammonia band. So when you knife in anhydrous ammonia, first of all, it freezes everything that is in there because it gets really cold right at the injection point. The other thing, it changes the pH radically. It gets really basic. And so that creates an area where it basically kills all the microorganisms that are in that retention zone. But there have been studies actually long time ago where people have looked at the proliferation of soil microbes in that band. And yes, it's basically everything gets killed within that retention zone, but then actually you get an increase of microbial activity very soon after, a couple of days, a few days after, you start to get recolonization and actually increases the amount of microbes because you have more available carbon and nitrogen in that retention zone. So that's the first one.
Right, yeah, and just to kind of follow up, what happens is the ammonia kind of diffuses out. You get water, rainfall, or irrigation, depending on the precipitation source. But anyway, that dilutes it out and makes it more habitable for the microbes, and they see a readily available source of nitrogen then and start using it along with the carbon in the soil.
That's right. And then as far as the destroying the organic matter, that's also one that has been floating around for quite a while, and the only way that you can really measure these things is with long-term studies. You cannot measure these things from a year to year. Organic matter is not something that changes drastically from a year to the next, or with changing of management practices. So you really need to look at these things over time. And the reason people talk about destroying organic matter is because anhydrous ammonia does solubilize the organic matter. It makes it more available, which also helps with the microbial activity that we're talking about. And so in reality, you can look at long-term studies with nitrogen fertilization, and the net effect is an increase in organic matter, because with nitrogen you produce more biomass, which you increase the amount of cycling of carbon back to the soil by having more biomass produced with the crops that you're growing. And so that's the net. The net effect is actually increasing organic matter rather than decreasing organic matter. And then the other big one was about soils being hard. And so when I started my career, I was really puzzled by that. I was like, I don't know about that. And so I started trying to figure this out. And then I talked to some of my colleagues that had more experience. And one of these colleagues had a lot of years of experience. And he told me, well, I think what happened is that back in World War II, they would use anhydrous ammonia to make runways. So they will apply anhydrous ammonia because it will freeze the soil. Like I mentioned, when you apply anhydrous ammonia, it freezes the soil. And they will use that to basically create a compacted area where you can land an airplane because it's frozen soil. But that's the only thing. It doesn't create a change in bulk density or make the soil harder. Again, it may be a very temporary thing while the soil is frozen, but right after that, it's not going to make a difference. And there have been plenty of studies showing that there is no a change in like bulk density or penetration resistance of the soil.
Well, and with anhydrous too, I mean, one of the things that does make it work well, as Fabian, we kind of allude to here with the microbial, what happens in that around that injection zone really is what makes it a very good fertilizer source, particularly for fall application, because it's really slows down at that point of where it's applied, that microbial activity, which will delay nitrification. Now, it's not an inhibitor itself, but just that little bit of slowing seems to make it work a lot better than urea. I mean, urea in a band, I mean, we probably not seeing as much of a benefit as it would with anhydrous just because of that having that what happens around there, particularly where it draws water out, it really has a big impact on the microbial activity. Then the other thing with the microbes too, and you know, this goes, you know, kind of with some things that I hear in terms of some of these microbial products, these specialty products of adding them to the soil, is we have a lot of microbes in the soil. So essentially what if you look at, if you're adding something to the soil, you know, is it going to have an impact just based on the fact that there's far more there? It's like a drop of water in the ocean in terms of what you're adding to there. And then in terms of recovery from anhydrous, I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, we're not flooding the entire soil, having an impact. We're completely sterilizing the whole soil zone. So it will start to recover, and it can recover relatively quickly if the conditions are appropriate. So it isn't as if we're killing everything that's there. And that's really what I think is the main thing to remember is, yes, there is an impact, but overall, I mean, the system will recover because that's just kind of the way it is. And with organic matter, I mean, a lot of our issues with organic matter, if you look at where things have stabilized, have come from tillage. I mean, the introduction, I think, of the air in there where we're changing what's going on within the soil, and that really tends to be where things moderate. Some of these other practices, I mean, really haven't seemed to have that big of a benefit or a drawback to that over time that we have, particularly with tilling the soil and working it. I'm not a proponent for 100% no-till in there, but we know that you start reducing that when you start to see some organic matter changes, particularly for the positive.
And drainage. That's and the drainage, other big one. Yeah. You know, tile drainage impacts how much aeration you get in the soil and how much the organic matter gets impacted by it.
Yeah, the oxygen stimulates the microbes eat use the organic matter, and so you need to replenish that through biomass or some other organic amendment over time.
And just to make one quick point, is what Dan was saying in terms of the total volume of the soil that gets impacted by anhydrous ammonia, it's a pretty small volume. Typically, you're looking at the ammonia retention zone is about 3 inches in diameter, depending on moisture conditions of the soil and a little bit of the texture. But, you know, 3 to maybe 6 inches at the most in a very dry soil, kind of sandy soil or dry soil. And so it's kind of a limited amount of space that really gets impacted. And within that retention zone, the concentrations are very, very high at the point of injection, and they diffuse and become smaller as you move out of that center point.
All right, last fact or fiction. Gypsum makes an excellent source of lime.
This one, you know, it comes up every once in a while for the benefits of gypsum, but one thing that we know with the liming source is really the calcium part, which is in gypsum, has no liming effect. Really, if you look at a regular ag limestone, which would be calcium carbonate or magnesium carbonate, it's really that carbonate component that has the effect on the liming. Other sources that have oxides also are a liming source. So gypsum itself, of the calcium sulfate, has no liming effect, even though it can affect pH in sodic soils, and it's typically used for remediation of sodic soils. But that's a whole different thing. I mean, we actually, in terms of liming, that's where we're looking at bringing the pH down instead of normal liming, which is bringing it up.
It's not the sulfur that's doing that. It's the calcium displacing sodium.
So sulfur by itself, now if we talk about other sulfur products, I mean, we really don't see a whole lot of liming with it. Ammonium sulfate is actually one of our more acidifying or most acidifying nitrogen sources. So actually it can have the negative impact we're talking about pH and decreasing pH. Elemental sulfur also is used for pH decreasing. Gypsum by itself?
Gypsum by itself is considered a neutral salt. So just because it has calcium in there doesn't mean that it's a liming source. As Dan said, the lime is calcium carbonate. It's a carbonate that does the neutralizing of the acidity. And gypsum, just because it has sulfate in there, the sulfur in there does not really acidify either. That's in the oxidized form, and so there's really no acidity being produced. Ammonium sulfate, the reason why that's acidifying is because of the ammonium in there. And it's the ammonium that goes through that nitrification process that produces the acidity. So gypsum, we consider that a neutral salt. It's beneficial in sodic soils. It displaces sodium. It's also a calcium and a sulfur source. So from that standpoint, if you need sulfur on your soil, gypsum is a source that can be applied.
And it's a byproduct, right, of energy generation for the most part. Yeah. And so it can be a useful source in that way of using as a byproduct, finding a use for a byproduct. Mm-hmm. But it has no relevance in terms of pH adjustment.
Yeah, and sometimes the calcium is looked for providing some additional soil benefits in terms of building soil structure. We've never really been able to prove that, although you end up hearing anecdotal evidence from growers. Mm-hmm. About tillage through areas where they've applied it where it seems to till easier. I mean, we can't really necessarily back that up. So right now, I mean, it is a fiction that it's a source of lime, but, you know, we view it as a moderately soluble source of sulfur. So there's some benefits out there for it, particularly mm-hmm. for a lot of crops. So it's not that it's not worth applying it. It's just don't view it as a liming source because it will actually not affect your pH at all.
It will not increase your pH. It will not act like a liming source. That is correct.
All right, interesting discussion. We'd like to thank the Minnesota Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFREC, for supporting this podcast. For the latest information on nutrient management, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at UMN Nutrient MGMT, where you can also send us your questions for future podcast episodes. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.